Okay, spoiler alert. I don't know if you've seen The Secret Life of Walter Mitty yet, but if you haven't, I'm going to wreck it for you. Because I want to talk about one of the scenes. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm not actually going to talk about the final scene, which is sort of like an important final scene, but a scene late in the movie. And by the way, it's a pretty good movie, so if you haven't seen it, you should go see it, even though now it's going to be ruined. Walter Mitty, throughout the course of this movie, played by Ben Stiller, he is trying to find this really rugged photographer that does all this nature photography for Time magazine and probably a bunch of other places. And towards the end of the movie, he finally catches up with this guy. It's been this epic hunt. And he finally finds him like on a peak in the Himalayas, I think. He had to go like through Afghanistan to get to this peak. And he finds him up there. He is camouflaged. He's been there for who knows how many hours or days because he's trying to catch a glimpse of the elusive ghost cat, the snow leopard. And he's got the lair of the ghost cat in the sights of his camera. And it's like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get a glimpse of this cat. Even people who try never do. And so Walter Mitty finds him. This photographer is played by Sean Penn. And they're sitting and chatting or whatever, and then the moment arrives. This snow leopard comes out of its lair, and Sean Penn taps him, and they look through the lens, and they take turns looking through the lens, and you see this beautiful animal come into the view of this camera lens. And it's like a little bit of a take-your-breath-away moment, because you feel the impact of this. Like, very few people get to live this moment that's happening right now. And they kind of take turns looking through the lens, and you start to feel this anxiety, like, click the shutter. Take the picture. And the cat is moving out of the field of the vision, and he's not taking the picture. And then Walter Mitty, Ben Stiller's character, he starts saying, like, are you going to take the shot or not? And you're feeling it like, my hand's going for my phone while I'm watching the movie or whatever. And he doesn't. And the Sean Penn character explains to him, you know, when I experience something like that where I feel it personally, I don't take the shot. Now contrast that with this. I have a friend of a friend who is a real estate agent who represents some of the most exclusive buildings in Manhattan and therefore some of the most exclusive buildings in the world. And he was at a signing for a unit in a building that outlines Central Park and so overlooks the park. And it was a $7 million property. And the guy, his client, was literally signing the papers for this property. Now, out the bay window, you could see and view One Central Park West, which is one of the most expensive, most exclusive buildings in existence. Like, the cheapest units in that building are in excess of $20 million, and they come with extra apartments for your servants or maids or cooks or whoever you have. So, and that's the cheapest buildings, the penthouse, who knows? So, but you can see out of this bay window, One Central Park West, this guy finishes signing the paperwork for a $7 million property that overlooks Central Park, stretches up, looks out the window, and says, I have got to get into that building. Something strange is going on here. How is it that some people seem to have the ability to enjoy the amazing things that happen to them in life? And other people seem to be unable to enjoy anything, no matter how amazing it is that happens in their life. What is going on here? There's a temptation not to enjoy the thing that is just in front of us and instead to be thinking about the next thing or what we don't have. And it's a temptation that I think all of us face. I certainly do. So recently I went with our global outreach team to the Dominican Republic and we were checking out some ministries there to see how we could partner with doing some cool stuff for God among really poor children in the Dominican Republic. And we had an incredible time. We're going to be filling you in about that over the next few weeks. But there are people that are just doing some awesome stuff, feeding these kids, teaching these kids, and there's some ways that we can partner with them, and it was just a great trip. Well, we're in Herrera, which is kind of a really poor part of Santo Domingo, and we go into this school that has been started for these kids that, you know, they don't have school, the neighborhood, there's no running water, medical care is really, really low, and we go into this school where they're taking these kids, they're feeding them at least, you know, a meal a day, And they're teaching them, and they're teaching them stuff about Jesus, and they're just doing all kinds of great stuff. And we go back into this back room, and there was like, I'm going to say like 24 3 to 5-year-olds napping. They had put mats down on the cement floor, and they were all tangled up in this heap, napping. They were so at peace, and they were all so deeply asleep that something happened. It was like a burning bush experience to me. Honestly, I felt like I just stepped onto holy ground. And everybody on the team felt it. It like took your breath away. You were in this kind of chaotic environment. You came around the corner and you just saw these children that were just, some of them were sucking their thumbs and they're just tangled up and they're snuggled up. And they were just all so deeply asleep. Immediately, like someone in the Wild West with his gun, like my hand went through my holster, my phone came out, and I started snapping pictures because I got to capture this. I got to share this. I've got to get this for later. And I start taking little video clips and all kinds of stuff. And that's not entirely bad because I do want to be able to share it. And you'll probably see some of those images. But of course, we all know when you're in instances like that, the image doesn't quite capture it. Because if you hadn't seen how the kids were living just outside the school, and if you didn't have the smells, and you hadn't heard them talk about the gangs and the danger, and you wouldn't get the full effect of what it was like to see these kids so safe and comfortable in this room. And it felt like we had wandered into holy ground. And so I'm snapping these pictures, and we all were, and at some point I realized, yes, I want to capture it, yes, I want to share it, but I'm missing it. Like, this thing is happening right now, and I'm missing it. And I kind of turned my phone off and put it in my pocket and just watched those babies sleep. And I'll never forget it. But how often do we do that? How often do I do that? I mean, how often am I in a conversation with somebody and I'm not really focused on them? I'm looking over their shoulder at the other person that I need to connect with. And how often have you felt that from somebody else? How often have I felt that from somebody else? I'm talking to you, but you're not really looking at me. You're looking over my shoulder. How often are we hanging out with our friends, but we're not really hanging out with our friends? We're checking what our other friends are doing on our phones while we're hanging out with our friends. And how many of the things that we have in our life do we not enjoy because we're so focused on, like, the next thing that we don't have? Like, we're not enjoying the stuff that we do have because we're thinking about the next thing coming that we don't have. How many times has God created an incredible moment in our lives, in your life, in my life? A moment that God was like, I wanted this for us. I wanted this for you. This is like a date for me. I created this for you and me to share, and we missed it because we were too busy. We were thinking about the next thing, or we tried to capture it instead of enjoying it. This thing, this tendency to, like, not enjoy the things that are right in front of us, the Bible calls this a grievous evil that weighs heavily on mankind. Now, those are some pretty big words, so I actually want to look at where it says that, because we're in this series called Press Play, and what we're trying to figure out is how to press play on the full life that Jesus promised, because Jesus came promising a full life, not just that we would stay alive, but that we would have a full life. And we've discovered as we've gone through this series that what we need to live the full life Jesus promised is a heart of wisdom. And so we've been looking at the wisdom literature. We kind of dipped in on Psalms, we dipped in on Proverbs. Today, I want to look at the book of Ecclesiastes. And so if you brought your own Bible, find Ecclesiastes chapter 6, because that's where we're going to look today. We'll also put the words up on the screen so you can follow along there. But this is where, in Ecclesiastes 6, this is where it says that that tendency is a grievous evil. And so I want to unpack what that's about and how we can live our lives differently to actually press play on a real life. Now, first thing you have to understand is who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, so I want to talk about him. His name was Solomon. It's a name you probably heard, even if you're brand new to church. He was a king. He's King Solomon. He was actually the son of a king. He was the son of King David, who's another famous Bible character. And this isn't really relevant for today, but just so you know, Solomon was also the son of a scandal. So his mom was Bathsheba, and King David fell in love with Bathsheba, who was another man's wife, and took advantage of her. And Solomon was her son. So for whatever that's worth to you, what God can do from what any circumstances that come through life is pretty incredible. So Solomon becomes a king, and early on in his life, he's got a very close walk with the Lord. And so at some point, the Lord does something a little unusual with him, and he grants him a request. It's almost like a genie. Like, God doesn't usually appear this way, but God appears to Solomon and says, I'll give you whatever you want. Just tell me. It's like you have one wish. And Solomon, he doesn't ask for wealth or power or that he would conquer his enemies or any of that. He asks the Lord for wisdom so that he can rule the kingdom well, so that he can govern well. And the Lord is so impressed with that request from Solomon that he not only grants it, but he gives him all the rest too. He says, you will be the wealthiest man alive. Your power will be unparalleled. I will give you victory over your enemies, and you will be the wisest person on earth. And that is who Solomon develops into. He is the wisest person alive in his day, in part because God gives him this spiritual gift of wisdom, and in part because of his vast human experience. This was a man to whom nothing was denied. Whatever you is available to you as a human being, Solomon had. He was insanely wealthy. I mean, he built palaces. He did these huge construction programs. He had like fancy wood being shipped down the rivers. He had materials from exotic places that he built his homes with. He was dressed so splendidly that hundreds of years later, when Jesus was looking for a metaphor of a really well-dressed person, he said, not even Solomon in all his splendor was so well-dressed. So Jesus thinks back to Solomon, he was so splendidly dressed. The man had literally hundreds of wives, we think about 300, and hundreds of concubines, we think about 700. So he had about 1,000 women at his disposal. He was incredibly wise and intelligent. He rubbed shoulders with kings and queens. Queens came to him for wisdom. He penned literature that has affected the major cultures of the world for thousands of years. He wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. He wrote most of the book of Proverbs. He wrote the Song of Solomon. But he's an incredibly wise, intelligent man. Nothing in all of human experience was denied to this man except maybe denial. So when he speaks out of his wisdom, it's a gift that God gave him, and also his own human experience. Solomon is a guy who's been there, and he's done that, and he's that out of that wealth of experience is talking to us. So I want to look at what he has to say, because Solomon in this passage says that this tendency not to enjoy what we have is a grievous evil that weighs heavily on mankind. We're going to look at Ecclesiastes 6, starting in verse 1. Solomon says, I have seen another evil under the sun, and it weighs heavily on mankind. Now, I just want to comment on that quickly because it's not the way we normally think about evil. We normally think about sin or forbidden things or evil as if they're really actually quite good. They're really actually kind of fun or pleasurable. And God is kind of a buzzkill, and it's kind of stinks to do the right thing. It would be great if we could do the wrong thing. So we name things like devil's food cake. We name it devil's food cake, or you'll say like sinfully chocolate things, because we have this idea that if something is desirable or pleasurable, that it's wrong, that it's evil. But Solomon is saying, I've seen an evil in the world that weighs heavily on mankind. Our backs are bowed under the weight of this evil thing. We are enslaved by the weight of this evil thing. Verse 2, here it is. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire. But God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them, and strangers enjoy them instead. This is meaningless, a grievous evil. Now, those are pretty big words for something that doesn't, you're not expecting that, right? Like, you're expecting a grievous evil to be one of these other kind of categories of sin. But Solomon is saying, man, I've seen an evil that weighs heavily on mankind. And it's that God gives people possessions and wealth and honor and good things, but they don't have the ability to enjoy them. This is a grievous evil. It's meaningless. It's so evil. Now, whenever I read stuff like this, I'm always wondering, like, you know, how much is Solomon speaking out of personal experience when he writes this? Because this is a man to whom nothing was denied. So when he says God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire, but he doesn't give them the ability to enjoy it, I just wonder, like, how much was he talking about himself there? Maybe not. Maybe he was talking about other wealthy, powerful people that he met, and he certainly met plenty of them. But I wonder how many days Solomon had that feeling, looking over his vast empire, knowing that he could have anything that his heart desired, and he just didn't know what he desired. That feeling that you get when you look in the fridge and you've recently gone grocery shopping, and so there's food in there, but you're just like, what do I want? I don't wish I could have that, but I don't really want it. And you kind of wander away or whatever. Or you're like channel surfing, and you're like, there's nothing on, but there's like 1,000 things on or whatever. And you're like someone from 2,000 years ago, if they could be transported into your room, would be like, and you're just like, boring, nothing on. Like, you have too many options. There's too many good things. You have all these wonderful things, but you don't have the ability to enjoy them. And Solomon is a guy where he could say, like, I'd like to build a palace today. And, like, someone will take care of that. He has 1,000 wives. I don't know how many servants it takes to tend to a harem of 1,000 wives and concubines. But if that starts to fill out your picture of how many people are at his beck and call, if he wants clothes made from different things, if he wants food from a different country, if he wants to travel, if he wants to write, if he wants to wage war, whatever he wants to do. And so I wonder if how much of this is him saying, like, man, this is a grievous evil. God gives some people wealth and possessions and honor, and they don't have the ability to enjoy it. This is meaningless. Verse 3, a man can have 100 children and live many years, yet no matter how long he lives, if he cannot enjoy his prosperity and does not receive proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. Now that's kind of an interesting, that's a pretty strong statement. First off, you have to understand, in that day, the greatest blessings life had to offer were children. That was what it was all about. So when he says a man could have 100 children, he's saying a man could have the best thing life has to offer. Now that's important to clarify, because you're probably like, 100 children? Lord, save me now! But in his day, that was an incredible thing. So he's like, a man could have 100 children and long life. That was like the second best thing you could have, a long life on earth. So a man could have it all, is what he's saying. A man could have everything that you can possibly get in life, and it's meaningless. It would be better if he had never been born. A stillborn baby has it better. So he's saying it'd be better that he never lived, even if he had everything life has to offer, if he doesn't enjoy it and he doesn't receive a proper burial. If he gets to the end of his life and people don't care about him. He invested in the wrong things. He was always going for the next thing. He didn't invest in relationships. And so when he dies, he doesn't get a proper burial because no one really cares about this guy. He's saying if that's the kind of life you get, you never enjoy anything, and no one cares about you, it's meaningless. It would be better if you had never been born. So it'd be better to not be alive than to be alive but not have a real life, not have the real life that Jesus has come to give, according to Solomon, the wisest man in his day. Here's my best attempt at kind of summarizing what this means for me, the message of this passage is for me and for all of us, I think. If I can't enjoy anything today, then I'll never enjoy anything. Now, I want you to let that sink in for a second. If I can't enjoy anything today, then I'll never enjoy anything. Now, as I always do every week, I'm going to attempt the Espanol of this line. I'm trying to make myself say at least one line. This one was kind of tough. So I just want you to, like, if you're a native Spanish speaker, just have some patience with me when I do this, okay? So, si no puedo disfrutar nada hoy, yo nunca voy a disfrutar nada. If I can't enjoy anything today, thank you. I appreciate the encouraging smiles from, like, the five people in the room. Or like everyone else is like, I'm glad you said it in English first, but whatever. So I promise you, like, I'm trying to learn, my focus this year is, like, learning Spanish, so I'm hoping a day will come where I can do more than one line when I'm up here, but please be patient with me in the meantime. If I can't enjoy anything today, I'll never enjoy anything. So Solomon's saying, if you can live 100 years, but if you don't enjoy it now, you're not going to enjoy it in 100 years. I want you to let that sink in for a second. What is eternity but an endless string of todays? So if you can't enjoy anything today, you'll never enjoy anything, ever. But man, talk about a truth that we want to just push back against. I want to push back against it. I'm going to be like, are you kidding me? If I had more money, of course, then I would enjoy my life better. Or you might be feeling like, if I had a different job, well, then of course I would enjoy my life better. If only I, and we could go all around the room, if only I had a healthy relationship, or if only I had a different family, or if only I had a family, or if only I hadn't gone through that thing, or if only I could get published, or if only we could have a baby, if only whatever, if only I could, then I would enjoy my life. And what Solomon is saying is, maybe, you may or may not enjoy those things if they came, but whether or not you do has a whole lot more to do with the posture of your heart and your mind than it does with the circumstances that are going on around you. Now, I want to just pause to clarify, I'm not making light of suffering, and I never want to make light of suffering. I've had a couple of doses of suffering myself in my own life, and so I would never want to say this line to someone who's hurting right now. And I hope no one in this room would ever do that. I hope you would never say to somebody, if you can't enjoy anything today, then you'll never enjoy anything, when they're hurting. Because when you're suffering, you're not supposed to enjoy that. It would be emotionally unhealthy for you to try to enjoy bad things that are happening. The only emotionally healthy response to pain and suffering is grief and sadness. So when someone is responding to hard things by being sad and grieving, they're actually responding in a very mature, healthy way, and you should never try to get in the way of that. That said, paradoxically, when I talk to people who are hurting, they often tell me how they've developed this appreciation and this gratitude for little things in their life. And it has a lot to do with whether they've fixed their mind and their heart on Christ. So, you know, just as an example, you have a guy who, like, loses his arm in a tragic accident. He might go either way. He might become bitter and frustrated and angry at God and angry at the universe and despair. Or he might go through that and grieve those awful feelings and then find himself oddly, paradoxically grateful for the arm that he does have. A whole lot more grateful for it than I am, because I take it for granted. And you'll find that people, you know, people who are suffering and people who are dying, they're like uber grateful for their relationships. You might come and spend 5 minutes with them at their bedside and they're crying. They're so grateful for it. Or uber grateful for the sunshine coming through their window. And so while I'd never want to say that to somebody who is suffering, and I hope none of us would, you will find, if you interact with people who are suffering, that a lot of times they discover this is true, that if I can't enjoy anything today, I'll never enjoy anything. And they find themselves grateful, not grateful for the pain and the suffering, but grateful for all the little good things that are happening. And setting that aside, setting suffering aside, most of us aren't really suffering. And if we were all being true to ourselves, I think we'd all have to admit that we actually have quite a lot. If you look at the whole arc of human history, we actually have a lot. We have a lot of stuff. We have a lot of good things. We have a lot of friends. We have a lot of health. We have a lot. Like today, at a minimum wage, if you work for an hour, you can buy enough ice cream to treat several friends at the grocery store. That was not true 100 years ago, 200 years ago. There is a lot in our lives. And I know it's not perfect. I know you're not where you want to be, and there's always something else you hope will happen, and I want it to happen for you. I want your lives to get better and better and better, and I want you to flourish, and quite frankly, I think God does too. I think God wants your lives to get better and better, and he wants you to flourish. It's just not his number one want. I don't know where it is on the priority, but there's some things that are more important, like the flourishing of your soul and the development of your character and the expansion of his glory. And I think what we're going to discover at the end of time is that actually happiness is contingent upon those things. That if your soul isn't developing and your character isn't developing and if God's glory isn't breaking forth, we can't be happy anyway. And so there are things that are more important than our happiness. But certainly you can see that in the same way, you can have everything and not enjoy any of it. Well, you can have many things and not enjoy any of it. And you can have a couple things and not enjoy any of it. And so I say again, if you can't enjoy anything today, you'll never enjoy anything. That is a profound truth, and it has some pretty huge implications. And I'd like to make a suggestion, an unusual suggestion about what we should do with this, what you should do with this. I say it's unusual because normally I'm recommending a new life-giving practice for you, or a new thing to incorporate in your life, or a resolution to make, or something new to do to take an advance towards Christ. But today, I don't want to do that. Today, I actually want to recommend that you commit today, instead, to enjoy something that you already have in your life. And I want to ask you to narrow it down to one thing. Let me just give you some examples to help get your mind going. So imagine like the realm of relationships, okay? So we've got all these wonderful relationships. Maybe the thing for you today is like you need to bring the date night back that kind of went away, and not from a perspective of we got to work on this marriage, we got to check this thing off because then that's the right thing to do and it'll be healthy, but from the perspective of God has given you an amazing thing. God has given you a marriage. He has given you someone to love, someone who will love you imperfectly but who will try to love you, and there are many people in the world who wish they had what you have. And so it's almost sinful, it's almost wrong for you to have this gift from God and not enjoy it. It is, in fact, a grievous evil that weighs heavily on the shoulders of mankind. Or you think about the different things in your relationship. So, like, you can let your mind go, but like bedtime story before bed. I can imagine how easy it would be to make that a thing you're just trying to get through because that hour of adult time is, like, just gold. But it doesn't have to be either or. It doesn't have to be either or. You could actually enjoy them both. You could get back to wherever you were when you first started reading those stories and make the funny voices and write your own stories or whatever and enjoy that time and actually enjoy it. Don't let it just slip by without doing it. I think about our relationships with each other, our friendships, and our church. And sometimes this might be as simple as just putting our phones away, honestly. I wonder if your everyday group, when you got together, if you guys talked this out and agreed to it together, but if you put a basket by the front door and had everyone drop their phone off on the way into group, I wonder how that might change your interaction. Might you start enjoying one another in a way you didn't imagine? Or if you go out to eat with friends, can everyone push their phone to the middle of the table and make a stack and have a rule like whoever reaches for their phone first is going to pick up the tab for everybody else? I won't be the first one to reach for my phone if that's the rule, I can tell you that. So, but can you work this thing out? And it's going to feel really awkward because we've gotten ourselves deep in this thing. So quick to not enjoy, so quick to not notice, so quick to not be present. We always want to capture, share, tweet, Instagram, whatever. We're not present. So sometimes it's as simple as just allowing yourself to be present and enjoy those relationships. Okay, so that's one area you might think about. You might think about things, and I'm not going to belabor this, but we have a lot of great things in our life. And this will kind of paint the picture for you. The difference between a cup of coffee that you knock back so you're awake for your 8 o'clock and a cup of coffee that you actually sip and taste and savor. Whew. Same cup of coffee, but we're talking about two totally different experiences. And if you can't enjoy anything today, you'll never enjoy anything. So think about your things. Things aren't bad. Things aren't good. They're just things. They can be good gifts. They can be used for bad things, whatever. But they can be gifts from God to enjoy. And it's a grievous evil not to enjoy the wonderful things that God has given us because we're worried about the things we don't yet have or need to have. Okay, one last area, but you could kind of, you know, apply this to any area of life. Think about your relationship with the Lord. Now, your relationship with the Lord is a relationship with the greatest being in existence. There's no one better. There's no one more beautiful. He is the best thing imaginable. He's so good that the best thing you can think of, he thought of that and actually made it. I mean, he is the best thing that you can imagine. And whether you realize this or not, I say this because I love you. He is the answer to all of your thirst, all of your hunger, and all of your desires. Nathan shared that scripture before. Come to me if you're weary, and I'll give you rest. This is where the gospel comes into this thing. Jesus is the answer. If you are weary, Jesus gives rest. If you are thirsty, Jesus says, I am the fount of everlasting water. If you come to me, you'll never thirst again. If you are hungry, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Jesus is the answer. When Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and in another breath he said, I've come that you may have life and have it to the full, Jesus is saying, I've come that you have a real life, and I am the way, the truth, and the life. So if you want a real life, that's me. You can have me. But we fall for all the shadows and toys and tricks and baubles and shiny things that are nowhere near as good as Jesus, and he's the best thing going. So maybe it's just a change of perspective for you of my relationship with the Lord, my talking with him. I'm going to start enjoying that. Now, I'm not saying discipline isn't important. Discipline is actually rather important. Jesus called his closest followers disciples, which means the disciplined ones. And we have wrong ideas about discipline. We think discipline are chains that bind our freedom. But in reality, they are life-giving practices that set us free from the chains of our own selfishness and our own sin. And there is absolutely a time and a place for discipline in our relationship with the Lord, which basically means a practice that you do whether you feel like it or not. Because certainly we all can imagine some things are good for you even when you don't feel like it. It's good to exercise even when you don't feel like it. It's the same thing with spiritual disciplines. But that's not the whole picture, because joy is one of the fruits of the Holy Spirit. And if you cannot enjoy God, if you cannot enjoy the best thing there is, something has gotten off track. Because this is the gospel, because of what Jesus did for us. You don't need to read your Bible or pray to earn your way into God's good graces. You don't need to check off that I spent some time with him today so that my relationship with him will be okay. But that is your relationship with him. So you don't have to do that. You get to do that. You don't have to come to church. You get to come to church. And I'd ask you to shift your perspective on enjoying the incredible privilege that Jesus has purchased for us on the cross, that we now each have full access to the best thing imaginable. So, for you to enjoy Jesus more, maybe you just need to set yourself free. Like, maybe you need to do something different. Maybe morning is not the best time for you to have a conversation with him. Maybe you need to do it at night. Or maybe your desk isn't the best place. Maybe a walk in the park is the best place. Or maybe, like, you're extroverted and doing this big, long chunk, trying to do this big, long, monk-like chunk of silence and solitude doesn't work for you. And maybe you need to, like, set yourself free to connect with a couple other people once a week for a prayer group or prayer partners or accountability group. And that's how you meet God, where two or three are gathered. There am I with them. And maybe you need to set yourself free for that. Maybe you need to put a cup of coffee in your hand. Maybe you need to start journaling, do something different. Or maybe you need to set yourself free from feeling like you should be journaling. But there's a role for discipline. Wow, some people that need to stop journaling. There you go. Stop journaling. There's a role for discipline in your walk with the Lord, but there is a role for joy, and it should be a discipline leading you to joy. Okay, so you can let your imagination go. Relationships, things, our best relationship with God. You could kind of talk this out and probably apply this thinking to a lot of different areas of life. But what I want to ask you to do today is pick one thing. And that might be kind of hard because there might be two or three things in your mind, but I'm going to force you to prioritize. I want you to pick one thing. And here's how I'm going to ask you to pick one thing. Hopefully when you came in, Nathan mentioned it, you got the little greeting card with the envelope. And if you did not, we have a couple of people who are going to stand up and we have some extras while I'm explaining how to do this. And so if you need one, give them like the little auction wave and they'll come get you one. Here's what I want you to do. First thing is I want you to flip this card over and I want you to write your mailing address on the envelope. And because I'm going to mail this to you. So this is going to become a note from you to you. So do me a favor. Let me give you 30 seconds. Flip the envelope over and write out your address on the envelope. Okay? Go. If you don't have a pen or you notice someone near you doesn't have a pen, please share. Just put your best mailing address so that when I drop this in the mail, you will receive this note from yourself. We give you maybe 10 more seconds to try to wrap that up. And obviously, you can keep working if you haven't finished, but I want to tell you what to write on the card. Okay, maybe 5. And try to bring your eyes back up here so you can see what to write on the card, even if you're not finished. So inside the card, you're going to write a 3-word note to yourself, like this. Name, your name. So in my case, it would be Chris. Enjoy blank. Now, maybe it's more than 3 words if that's a phrase, but it could be Chris, enjoy Lindsay. Chris, enjoy napping. Chris, enjoy prayer. Man, that's something I need to remind myself of. Like, enjoy prayer. Don't slog through it. Enjoy it. For you, it might be, Adam, enjoy music. Or Tabitha, enjoy the city. Man, that's something we forget to do. Like, the city's cool, right? Enjoy the city. Or Natalie, enjoy silence. Or whatever that thing is. Enjoy the Bible, whatever that thing is. Pick it, write it down. Put your name, enjoy, thus. Fold that card in half, put it inside the envelope, seal it. And then at the end of the service, when you leave, you'll pass the resource table out in the lobby on your way out. And I just want you to put it on that resource table. It's okay if it's like an untidy pile. I'm going to collect them personally, and I'm just going to take them home. And in a month or two, I'm just going to put a stamp on them and drop them in the mail to you. And I'll be curious to see how God uses that, the moment when that letter from you to you, reminding you of what you felt like God was saying to you today, what you should enjoy. Here's what I'm hoping. that maybe as this full life takes root in our heart and grows in our souls and eventually blossoms into eternal life, that God will bit by bit transform each of us into the kinds of people who in heaven can enjoy everything.